Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm
Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
John D. Pasquale with us. He is the author of The True Adventures of a Vagabond. He's a retired chief warrant officer, special agent with the U.S. Department of Defense. He became one of the highest decorated in his field as a criminal investigation division special agent. And his book, again, is called The True Adventures of a Vagabond. John, hi. Welcome to the show.
Evening, sir.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with, you know, those things that most people with the Department of Defense, most people that don't want to know, but we end up getting the information anyways, before we get into the subject of the book, are we in the world that we live in today giving away too much information through the media?
No doubt about it. We need a lot more secrecy in what we do. And a good example is going in killing bin Laden. The reason why that was successful is because nobody told anybody we were going in.
Now, and by the way, when we did, nobody told us, I mean, we didn't tell anybody we were going in, but at the same time afterwards, we've got a leak in some of the media and one of the Special Forces team that went in, the Navy SEALs team that went in, they know now about, everybody knows now about the special helicopters and so on and so forth. There's just so much information going on. Where do we draw the line? If you had the magic wand, the wherewithal to draw the line and say information stops here, where would that information stop?
Well, you know, it's very difficult in an open society. I mean, after the operation, that information was disseminated to news organizations, to people around the government, and it's going to get out. It's almost impossible to stop. It's almost impossible. When I worked narcotics, if I told a commander what I was going to do, the whole installation knew about it. So I had to go in and not tell anybody what I was doing, and then after the arrest, tell them what I did.
John, if you said what you were going to do beforehand, that would have put you at risk, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, no doubt about it, because then they'd know we were doing an operation on that particular installation.
Now, when we deal with, you know, the true adventures of a vagabond, taking a look at the highest levels of government intelligence information, have you seen a change over the years? Do you see a different form of culture within the government that causes us to do what we do or what we don't do?
Yeah, it's gotten a lot worse. Everybody wants to tell everybody what's going on, and you just can't do it. We need some sort of secrecy, especially within the government, on operations like that, because people's lives are at stake. And they don't just realize it. They don't understand that when you talk about an operation that's going to be coming up, everybody's going to find out about it. That's why most of our operations are not successful.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the problems that we have right now is, and I would venture to guess, it's got to be the drug trades, you know, from Mexico to the United States, the borders here, and also in Europe, and I know the book concentrates a lot on that, but the drug trade in and of itself, there's so much money that passes hands that is it very hard to get to the source, the core of those people that are actually, you know, manufacturing and creating and selling the drugs because of somebody at a higher level being paid.
It goes all the way up. In fact, in my book, you remember the CIA inquiries that they did many years ago about CIA involved with smuggling drugs in Colombia to
yes.
Panama?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that was... that was somewhat true. I met a captain that was involved with Operation Watchtower, and he was telling me how they were loading up military aircraft, and they were using special operations teams. They were loading up C-130s in Colombia and flying them to Panama, to Noriega. And only when Noriega failed to cooperate with us in other matters, we decided to go after them for the narcotics.
So, now, by the way, how much, and when I think it's going to be an interesting question, how much ability do we have to go after the guys? And when I say that, there are certain borders you can't cross, and if you do covert operations within those borders, you know, you're basically declaring war on them. Where do you know where to draw the line? And I personally, when it comes down to what the kind of things that you do, there should never be a line. But where do you draw that line where if the information does come out, if something does happen, those countries that you're working in, where do you get to a point where they don't charge you as a criminal? John, do I still have you? Do we lose you?
Yeah, I'm losing you for some reason.
Oh, okay. I think we're back together. Let me repeat the question.
Sure.
And in doing the work that you did, where do you draw the line? Because there are those points in those countries you can't go back, you can't go in and get them because of those higher levels of control that they have over the drugs, whereby you don't get arrested as the criminal. I think there's got to be a very thin line in the way that you would work, and if you would work undercover, especially that would cause a problem in being able to do your job without getting in trouble with one of those countries you're working in.
Well, we definitely have the expertise to go anywhere in the world and get anybody out. I mean, that's obvious. The problem is it becomes political afterwards. Even though it's damaging their country also, you know, they just don't want American troops with guns, you know, on their lands.
No, and very true, because take a look at what's going on right now. I think it's, you know, our, who is it? It's, I'll think of it. I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember his name. But we've got people now that were CIA, that were intelligence, that are now being charged with criminal activity because of certain ways that they dealt with those prisoners, you know, the enhanced interrogation and so on and so forth. So it's very you run a real interesting place. Not only do you have to worry about the people that you're going out after hurting you, that when you come back, that if you didn't do it exactly within the scope of whoever those people who are controlling the rules, you could end up in jail yourself, which would seem to me that it would kind of stop you, hinder you from doing the job.
Absolutely right. I mean, I was in special operations in Morocco, where we had some elite troops training some of the Moroccan troops. And, of course, we flew over in a military aircraft, and we weren't allowed to have any weapons with us because that's what the country required. But as an agent, I had to smuggle my weapon in, 9mm. Now, of course, we're on military aircraft, so, you know, the military wasn't going to stop me. But I was a security for the commander in charge. Now, of course, as a security agent, I'm not going to go over there with sticks and knives. You know, I'm going to go over with a gun. So I had to smuggle it in. If I got caught in Morocco with that gun, they probably would have arrested me.
Now,
and the government would have said, oh, we didn't know he had a gun.
Now, by the way, right, and throw it all back on you.
Yeah.
Is there anything when you're in training, is there any part of that training that says, here's the downside? Here's what we can't do. Here's where we won't back you up. But yet we want you to go in with full energy and 100%, 110% attitude towards this. There isn't anything that says that, is there?
Not at all. Just charge the hill and we'll talk about it later.
Yeah. Yeah. And
just accomplish the mission. We don't care how you do it. You know, it's plausible deniability. Just do it. I don't care how you do it. Do it, get results, and if you get results, if you don't get caught because you did something that you weren't supposed to do, you're fine. If you got caught, well, we didn't know he was doing it. And they were right. They didn't know because, of course, that's what makes our military so unique. Unlike the rest of the militaries in the world, when our military gets a mission, that's it. They complete that mission. They don't have to go ahead and call in every 2 minutes, say, okay, I did this, I did that. You know, we could go in, we accomplish the mission, then we get out, and then we do our briefings. Other countries don't act like that.
Now, by the way, with people coming into this, you know, I've got your background in the press release. Basically, you dropped out of high school, you got yourself in some trouble, you ran some numbers, and then you did a few things. I think the point here is very important. A person can go to school and they can become educated. The education does not, John, give you any kind of wisdom. It's that street smarts that I would venture to guess in the end result when you got put up against the wall that allowed you to survive.
You hit the nail on the head. I met a lot of educated idiots when I was chief of narcotics. Everybody wanted to work narcotics. There were people that I'd be afraid to put on the street because they wouldn't know what to do. I looked for inner city guys that grew up in big cities. I didn't need any country boys to go out there to get killed. You know, I wanted people that knew the streets, knew drugs, and I've always, every place I've worked narcotics, I always had the highest seizure rate in that particular area because I always used the key people. And you're right, I'd done some bad things growing up in New York, but I was growing up in New York. But that made me street smart.
Sure.
I worked narcotics for several years in Europe. I worked in Asia. And I tell you, I used to get by from Turks, Africans, Asians, and they'd sell me anything. Because I knew the streets.
But let me ask you this question. I think it's an extremely important question to ask. Kids going in today, going into the military, choosing the occupations, knowing what we know now about the media and how it's going to be politically bent based on ideology and everything, does that put a damper on those people who could really do the job? Do they look at it and take a second thought and say, maybe I don't want to do this?
No, because it's the excitement. You're young. You want to get into that. You want to carry a gun. You want to do investigations. You want to work undercover. Everybody wants to work undercover. You know, they think
sure.
it's fancy, but it's not.
No, it's romantic. It's sexy. It's all this stuff. But
a lot of work.
Yeah, in the end result, they don't realize what kind of work there is. Okay, let me ask you this question. We're starting to run out of time. John, I picked the book up, The True Adventures of a Vagabond. I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I get out of that book that I didn't have before I read it?
Well, I think you see somebody that grew up under adverse conditions in a bad area, started off wrong. I tried to get out of my environment, but you know, stealing a car wasn't the way to do it.
No.
But eventually I did, and I got myself educated, self-educated, went to college. In fact, graduated Central Texas College with a 3.8, and I never had a high school diploma. I lied about that. and I went. I became a military policeman. Then I started working narcotics, then became an agent, and then became one of the highest decorated in my field. So you could start off under adverse conditions, but you don't have to be like that the rest of your life. But it takes you to do it. And don't listen to what anybody says. If you want to do something, go and do it.
You know, by the way, that's really what it comes down to. And one thing, no matter what's going on politically today in this country, and I've been in this country for a lot of years now, you know, I go way back a bunch of years, the one thing that we do still have is still freedom of choice. And that's the one thing we shouldn't let anybody ever take away from us.
Got to fight on that. We got to fight on that one. That's right.
Yeah.
We have a lot of creativity in this country. And I've been all over the world. And most of the places in the world I've been, very little or no creativity at all. Because it's the status quo. I'm going to work. I'm just going to do my job. I'm not going to do any extra.
No, absolutely. And it's this key thing, and I think in the high schools it should start. Your book should be in the high schools, and the message within the book should be in the schools. Because if somebody runs out for sports, you can't all get a medal at the end of the day. Some people win, some people lose.
But that's what they do. that kids nowadays, you know, you go and even if you lose, everybody gets a medal. Everybody gets a trophy. There's disappointments in life. And we have to learn how to take those disappointments, get over it, and then move on. Look, no matter what you're going to do, it is going to be an obstacle. Thing is, you have to be creative on, do you go over the obstacle? Do you go around the obstacle? Do you go under? You got to have that creativity to know how to do that.
No question. And the creativity comes from living a life where you get the ability to do that creativity, living in a country the way we live in. And thank God you guys were out there and the kind of people like you were out there to be able to make sure that we can get on the radio and say what we're going to say, go to the store and not worry about somebody breaking into our house and taking us away. So knock on wood, and I think it's great, and everybody should get the book.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hey, John, thank you so much. A website we can find you at.
Website is the trueadventuresofavagabond.com.
trueadventuresofavagabond.com. And I'm on your side. June 21st, 1960, I was standing tall at Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. So knock on wood, go get them.
Oh, is that right? Okay. I've been in San Diego. In fact, if you read my book, you'll see that when I sailed from San Juan Island, I wound up in San Diego for a while.
Yeah, no, I hear you, man. But those were the days where San Diego, we got to go, but it was a very, very sleepy little town of about 50,000.
Yeah, no more. So,
I know. Hey, John, thank you so much for joining
us. Anytime, you know, call me anytime if you want to talk more.
Oh, you got it. We'll have you back on. Thank you. Good night.
Okay. All right, good night.
Get up and just go there. Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. Dr. Lynn Cleland coming up with us momentarily. The book is Save Our System, Why and How We the People Must Reclaim Our Liberties Now. Dr. Cleland, Lynn Cleland, has a broad range of life experiences to draw from. He's a writer, operations manager, research leader, university professor, and a farmer, and each role and landscape provided him with a rich background about people and system dynamics. And after a thriving 40-year career in complex systems engineering and operations management, he decided to apply his professional knowledge to his growing personal concerns, those concerns about our nations. And Lynn, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you. My pleasure.
And thank you so much for being here. Save Our System, Why and How We the People Must Reclaim Our Liberties Now. I think the most important, the operative word there, Lynn, is a lot of us, and I won't say all of us, a lot of us know why, but I think the big question is the how. What do you do? What's that first step to bring back what was and make sure what could happen doesn't happen?
Well, I think the most important first step is to try to get people better educated as to what the real problems are, what caused them, and why we need to fix them. Then we can start working on solutions And I do all of that, of course, in the book, and then try to provide individuals with information and knowledge about what they personally can do once they are armed with the information that that we face, the problems that we face.
Len, I think that's the major problem. We get hit with so many media messages, and they're mixed. And based on what you're watching, if you watch Fox News, you may hear one thing. Watch CNN, you're going to hear something else, CNS, but whatever. It's so confusing out there that the average person has no idea of the dynamic that occurs with these ideological bents that we have in our government. There are so many committees, and a committee to get a committee to get a committee. We are so broke we can't even see straight, yet we're giving billions of dollars away to other countries. We are spending, I think it was $3 billion, I think that was the number I heard, on research. And one of those research projects was, what was it? It was shrimp. Do shrimp exercise. So I don't quite get it.
Yes, we clearly have a priority problem in our system. Basically, this is where the book comes into play. I mean, I think every American, or at least most Americans, really want to do what's right for the nation and select leaders that are going to give us a path forward to 2076 that we can all be proud of, and more importantly, that our younger generations can live in. And yet we're all, as you pointed out, Michael, we're all so busy, or most of us are so busy with our families, our careers, you know, just making a living. And what we get, of course, are a bunch of sound bites from television and radio and elsewhere, mostly driven by improving ratings rather than providing information.
Oh, I think it's about 95% improving ratings. You know, there's that old adage, if it bleeds, it leads, and death, dying, and destruction become entertainment. And there's that line that bleeds over that sometimes we don't actually see. We start to see things, and I am sorry, I didn't write his name down because it happened so fast. But there was one of our elected officials about 2 months ago, and I happened to catch him quickly on television. I was walking by, and the exact words out of the man's mouth was, "This silly Constitution." And I think that's where the problem is. It's not a silly Constitution. It is the Constitution that allowed us to be who we are. And if it weren't for guys like yourself doing what you're doing, getting the information out, I think we'd be in an absolute mess. I sit back and I look at what's going on with our educational system. I look at what's going on with the economy. And then I listen to what's coming out of the administration, and everything that's said doesn't seem to have any water to it, no basis.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. And that's, again, what I try to do is to link basically four topics. One is the tactics and tricks that the politicians use to scare, mislead, seduce, and manipulate us, and that's what you just described. The second is the government systems that are near failure or have significant deficiencies. You also mentioned some of those. Third is political leadership and the parties that exasperate our problems rather than solve them.
Now, by the way, that in and itself could be an oxymoron, political leadership anymore.
Well, I generally put it in quotes. So anyway, I think it's important for people to understand what some of those things are. Then there's a lot of things that we can do, I think, as a group about them. But if you don't know the problem or don't understand the problem, it's awfully hard to get motivated to dig into it to try to fix it.
See, what I don't. Well, by the way, what was that fourth one? You had the three of them. I missed the fourth one.
Okay, it's a tactical tricks politicians use. Government systems that are failing or insufficient in some way, the political leadership and parties that exasperate them, and the fourth one are possible solutions to each of these areas, as well as what individuals can do to make a difference.
Now, by the way, it gets scary because I don't know if an individual can do anything anymore on a practical basis. I will never stop believing that one vote counts. I'll never stop believing that. I am so American, I squeak, okay? I was born in this country. I've watched things go on in this country, and I'll die for this country. And at the same time, I am watching the trend, and I have to use the word trend in quotes, that it's not a trend to a republic or a democracy. It is a trend towards socialism. It is a trend towards governmental takeover. Because if you go back and you look at the dynamic of what occurred right before the Second World War in Germany, Hitler took over. He nationalized the schools, education. He nationalized the banks. He nationalized. You know, by the time he was done, they owned everything. And if we look at the steps that are going on right now, you can see the same thing. And that's
You're exactly
not saying
correct. I cover that, and I cover it in a very serious way in the book. In other words, we have a number of our governmental systems, including the whole system itself, that are at tipping points. That is, if we don't make some changes in the way we do things, we're going to not have a country as we have known it in a very few years. So it's important for people to understand that. You brought an interesting question about, you know, what can an individual do? Let me just give you a quick example by asking you a question. Do you have any idea what you personally owe as a result of the government's combination of debts, including unfunded liabilities?
I'm going to take a wild guess, at probably on a personal level, probably over $200,000 to $300,000.
Right, you're pretty darn close. And if you add federal, state, and local stuff together, it gets worse. So, how many people do you think in this country understand that they have that debt hanging over their head? Every man, woman, and child in the country has that hanging over their head. If they knew that, if the young people today knew that, okay, that one thing, then I suspect we might have something happen in this country that's not unlike what's happening in the Middle East right now. Young people are going to say, wait a second. I'm worrying about $25,000 or $40,000 for my education, and you're telling me that my governments have already indebted me by that amount? How come? If you're a parent of one of those children, you say, oh, you know, I wouldn't do that to my kids. So why did it happen? Well, it happened because the career politicians played these games, these tricks, to convince people that everything's okay, and it's still going on. You know, I can give you several examples if you're interested.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, let's just take the deficit speech of Obama, and the Republicans have their own plan. If you take a look at the Democratic plan that Obama presented and do the breakdown, we've got a deficit of $1.6 trillion. But if you take and decipher what he said and do it on an annual basis, what he's going to do is reduce annually about $330 billion, in other words, 20%. So what he's proposing doesn't fix 80% of the problem. The Republicans' proposal doesn't fix 70% of the problem. So what are they doing? Well, what they're doing is once again conning the American people into believing that they're taking seriously this problem. But as long as there's a deficit, the debt will continue to grow. So they're not fixing the problem. We've got to educate people as to what these kinds of tricks are that they use, and so they become sensitive to them and can call their politicians on it.
Yeah, Lynn, let me hold you up for a second, because I think an important word, we rule, our life is ruled by definitions. Definitions cause us to be and do who we are when we move down a particular pathway. And the word, we keep hearing the word deficit, 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 you know, in the fiscal year. The word deficit means shortage, and I wonder if many people even understand that that's what it means. Fiscal means financial. It's the difference between what the government
Correct.
Takes from taxes and other revenues and the amount of money that the government spends. And the difference between the two is the shortage. Now, the key is, if we have a shortage, then we require the Treasury to borrow money to raise the cash that's needed to keep the government operating. And what do? We sell Treasury securities, you know, we sell T-bills, notes, bonds, savings bonds, whatever. And we sell them. And the problem is there's nothing to back them up. We are so indebted to China right now that it's almost a laughing stock. You know, you want to raise the debt ceiling. Is it a debt ceiling or is it a glass ceiling? You know, it's so confusing to most people. And when you get into, at one time, millions confuse people. But now you start to talk about billions and trillions. I wonder how many people on the street and how many zeros is behind $1 trillion.
Well, let's see. If you take a trillion, take our deficit this year and say, since the beginning of the solar system, for every day you save a dollar. That's how many dollars you would save since the beginning of the solar system. Okay,
sure.
The sun didn't exist 1.6 trillion years ago, days ago. So, you know, you got to bring things down into terms. You're just right. You got to bring things down into terms that people understand. And that's why I'd like to keep reminding them in terms of what their piece of the action is.
See, here's the big problem that I think we have, and I've watched this for a long time. We don't do anything for we don't do any manufacturing. We don't create our own anymore. So effectively, the good Japan, China, Europe, wherever, see, they import goods to us. We pay cash for the goods. Now, those countries we pay cash to invest the money back into the United States by the securities and the bonds and treasury bills, et cetera. So what we're really doing is we're spending money with them that we don't have, and then they're taking that money and they're buying us. Now
that's
they
correct.
Own a piece of us, and it gets so hard to pay back that we have to, we're basically in control, they're in control of what we do. I bet you any amount of money that most people, if they traced who owned the note on their home, they'd find it come out of a bank in China somewhere.
You're absolutely correct. And printing money is not the solution. There's never been in history a country that survived their debt by printing more money. And yet that's the other option in addition to handing it out to the – or letting it be a part of a Japanese or Chinese or oil country.
Sure.
The other thing that's why that we're at a tipping point there, and this is also I cover with along with a number of other – things that are part of a rising storm. Let's suppose you're China, and you've got $1 trillion worth of paper that you're covering in the United States, and the United States continues to let its debt rise. What are you going to think about doing? You're going to think about unloading that stuff as quickly as you can, buy up as much stuff as you can, buy as many commodities and so forth, and stop covering our debt.
Sure.
If they stop covering our debt, if the foreign countries stop covering our debts today, we would have a huge depression.
Big time. Big time. There's no
Big
question
time.
About that.
The other thing that's interesting to consider, and that is, right now the dollar is the world currency, basically. Suppose it no longer was the world currency, and in fact, China and Russia have agreed not to use dollars for their trades.
That's on the horizon.
Suppose that happened worldwide, we would also sink like a rock. So we got to clean this mess up, and people have to understand we are going to have a warlike stance, not unlike the Second World War, where every American is going to have to understand the problem, do some sacrificing, and move forward, or we're going to be in bad shape.
No question. Lynn, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at? And
yes,
by the
I do. Yes, we have several. Of course, it's available on Amazon.com and elsewhere. It's also available in various ebook forms. But my website is www.saveoursystemnow.com.
Got it. And by the way, Lynn Cleland, thank you so much for being here. And again, the book is Save Our System, Why and How We the People Must Reclaim Our Liberties Now. And when we look at the deficits and we look at the dollars that are being spent, that affects liberty. We're pretty much owned by somebody else at this point, and it's time that we did take it back. And you take it back by creating our own manufacturing, doing our own drilling, becoming independent again, and not having to worry about a foreign source that if we don't do this or we don't do that, to continue on with the kind of lifestyle that we have. Anyways, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure, Michael. Have a good day.
Well, you too. Good night.
Good night.
I I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. But that's all.
Michelle Manafee with us, co-editor of Dancing with Digital, Digital Natives Staying in Step with the Generation that is Transforming the Way the Business is Done. She's the director of content for a UK-based digital publisher, Free Pint Limited, an award-winning writer and an editor. Her focus is on emerging trends of digital content and how they shape successful business practices. In addition to writing on such technology topics as digital publishing, content development, social media, Michelle is a sought-after speaker and a dedicated mentor to many digital natives. And let us say, Michelle, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the book in and itself, we're really learning how to speak a new language, aren't we?
Well, I think every generation struggles with this, the differences between the communication styles of the ones that come after it and the ones that precede it. And I think here we're definitely facing a completely new language, as you suggest.
Yeah, and then when we deal with it, some of the kids that are being raised today are completely different from those millennials that will be taking over everything pretty soon. And I think that the real key here is if you don't stay abreast of what's going on, if you don't stay up with this transition into the technical age, I think a lot of businesses are going to be in trouble, because we even have a brand new consumer as opposed to those people in businesses that have to deal with this.
Well, I think a lot of times businesses focus on staying abreast of current technologies, and they look at the technological solutions. They say, for example, I need to use collaborative technologies, or I need to use social media technologies. But when we look at a generation that's literally grown up immersed in these technologies, I mean, it truly affects their fundamental behaviors. It affects their worldview. It certainly affects the way they work, the way they like to be entertained, and definitely the way they consume things, which I think all businesses are pretty interested in tapping into their consumption patterns.
No, absolutely. Susie Greenman, who produces the show, Susie's daughter, I think she's 21 now, and she graduated high school when she was 18 years old. She was one of the last kids that remember what it was like not to have a cell phone. So it's here now.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally, yeah. And when I say that there's a language, you're right. Each one of the decades or whatever it is that changes, they transition to another culture, changes, and it changes so drastically today. I think, Michelle, one of the scary things is that what you might be in touch with, in tune with technology, 3 weeks from now can be completely different. And if you don't have those kids that have got it together and are living that, you're going to get lost.
Well, I think that when you look at this generation, the difference between those of us who are in more transitional generations. You know, you're on streaming radio. Clearly, you're what is considered a digital immigrant. You're not someone who shies away from these technologies, you know, but you and I both came to them later in life. We definitely weren't raised on them. And when you look at a generation that literally has been raised with this rapid pace of change, with this Moore's Law mentality, it is a lot more comfortable for them, where we might every day get up and almost dread, oh no, what do I have to face today? What do I have to learn and work? What kind of wacky jargon is going to be thrown at me? For them, this is just the way things are. Every day is a new opportunity to embrace change, embrace progress as they see it, and go out and make the most of it.
I like the way you skirted around saying, instead of not saying we, the older generation.
certainly, you know, one of the interesting things about this generation is that while we say digital natives are basically born since 1985, you know, there is no hard and fast line because it depends a lot on socioeconomic factors, where you live in the world and so forth. But yeah, those of us who are a little bit older maybe.
Yeah, and when it really comes down to it, you see the world differently, but you only see it differently because of the way that you were brought up, what was available to you and what you could use and take advantage of to accomplish any kind of a goal that you wanted. But I think most importantly, when you're dealing with this kind of an age and this kind of the natives, quote unquote, the digital natives, and that's what they truly are. If you're not one of them, you'll have to have some kind of a roadmap, a blueprint to be able to understand them, because a lot of them are not understandable. And one of the things that's happened at this age, that sense of humanity seems to be diluted at this point, and it's more technical than it is touching.
Well, one thing I am going to say is that with the book Dancing with Digital Natives, we really do strive to provide that type of roadmap to not only translate their behaviors, sort of, you know, do some sense making, but also provide you readers with actionable insights, you know, ways in which they can say, okay, what does it mean and what do I do with it? How can I act? How can I go and make this behavior actually work for me, for my business objectives? As an educator, you know, to actually help them learn and help them achieve their goals and the goals that I have for them. But when you refer to the technology and the lack of humanity, I mean, that's a hard one not to feel. I think when you look at a generation that would rather text, they'll be standing in a crowd and they'd rather be texting each other than talking to each other, than looking at each other face to face, there's no doubt that you get a cold feeling in your stomach and you say, oh no, do they even, you know, are they humans? Are they cyborgs now? You know, but the fact is that basic, that technological basis for communication is highly socially mediated. The fact is that so much of the way in which they use and relate to technology is highly social. Almost everything they do online is social. It just isn't social in the ways in which we're familiar with. They are one of the most highly networked and collaborative generations we've ever seen. This is a generation that wants to crowdsource things. They want to work together on things. And they actually value things that have been crowdsourced, or even better, things with which they have had an influence or an impact on as it was created or as it was brought to market. So they are, in many ways, more social. It's just, as you suggest, the technology for us can make it seem cold or disaffected, disconnected. But, in fact, they are more connected in many ways.
And one of the things that's a plus on that side also, and it's probably been mentioned on the air quite a few times, when you're dealing with people and social networking, there's that old 6 degrees of separation where if you were to reach out at one time, what could you touch? 25, 35, 100 people. Now you can sit in your backyard in the sun by a pool and reach out to hundreds of millions of people with a text message.
Well, and if you do it in a way that is natural, where it's your natural language, as the natives do, you make genuine connections by doing it. I mean, a lot of times you'll see companies do things like automate Twitter feeds, you know, where it's clearly a machine generating tweets, or they pay a third party to generate tweets. This generation is hyper aware of those types of behaviors. To them, that is not truly social. I mean, when we look at social networking and socially mediated technologies, don't forget the social part. Social skills matter. Interaction, genuine, honest interaction matters more than ever.
Well, see, here's the key also, as we're talking. I've got a bunch of people who follow me on Twitter. Radio Susie's got a bunch of people who follow her on Twitter. BBS has tons of people who follow them on Twitter. And I think just between Radio Susie and myself, we're probably talking about anywhere from 25 to 30,000 people that are following on Twitter. And then you add however many BBS has, and then each time, like this interview that we're doing right now, there is a Twitter going out about it saying that you and I are talking and interviewing, tune in now. Where did we have that before? And those people who that the tweet will go to somebody else and somebody else, Facebook and all of them, they follow that. I mean, I remember I've spent, this is my 28th year as a broadcaster, and I've been syndicated on bunches of shows all over the country, back and forth and whatever. And I'm beginning to realize that, radio will always be there, but there is a new source, and that new source is the internet. And the internet radio, I was shocked to see the amount of people that are listening to the internet. We had, a guest about 3 or 4 weeks ago. She sent an email the next day and said her Amazon ratings shot up, and this is off of the internet. They're very powerful.
Well, I definitely think, especially when you look at the change between when I was in journalism school 20 years ago and the way that information is disseminated today. I mean, it definitely used to go through us. We used to get to be gatekeepers, and we used to get to decide what mattered and what was important. And we were lucky if we had, a good circulation for me in magazines or for you, on air. Today, you really can't necessarily predict how many people you're going to reach with a message. And almost any message that you put out needs to be put out in that context. This could go on. This could be a meme that just goes on infinitely.
Sure.
It's spread forever. And I think definitely when we're, when we're talking about digital natives and mentoring them and helping them achieve the goals that we actually want, we have to remember to reinforce that type of knowledge. Not only the resonance and the potentially viral spread of ideas, but the potentially negative aspects of that as well.
Sure.
That we have to remember that everything we put out there is our face. One of the contributors to the book, Dan Schwabel, he wrote a book called Me 2.0, and it's about personal branding. Thinking about putting yourself out there every day in the context of anyone could see this and anyone could see it forever. And as brands, as companies, we have to be thinking about that as well.
Well, absolutely. And I think one of the things that has stayed constant through the years when you're dealing with communication, and I've been in communication touching, I'm going to tell you, but you got to promise this is our secret. Okay, good.
I'm going to tweet it, so go ahead.
Okay, good. All right, great. No, I've been in communication just touching 40 years now, and the one thing that's been constant is that when you're doing communication, you do not talk to a group. You talk to everybody individually, and the message has got to be viral. Even way back when I first got into radio, it was the same thing. I didn't learn that until probably 8 to 10 years later. But as I began to learn it, what I'm seeing is the same message applies. It's just the delivery system becomes different.
Well, to a large extent, I mean, I agree with you. But when you look at it, it's something like collaboration. I'm guessing you've worked in teams before. It sounds like you have a pretty good relationship with your producers, for example. The book is it's 20 different contributors, and they all chime in with their voice. But when you look at something that's actually crowdsourced, something that goes out and is touched on and influenced by, shaped by, an infinite number of people, where the most popular or hopefully the best product surfaces and is produced, it's an issue of scale.
You know, you while we might put together the best and the brightest minds to work on something in a team, when you look at, for example, Procter & Gamble has a collaborative platform called P&G Connect, where it actually makes its intellectual property available publicly so that anyone out there can chime in and help influence, help shape its ideas. This idea of, you know, not just small innovators, you know, young digital native entrepreneurs getting out there and making their ideas public and working on them as a crowd, but that large organizations are very successfully getting out from behind, you know, the cubicle walls and crowdsourcing things to make them better. I mean, again, it's an issue of scale, and it's an exciting one.
Well, there's no question about it. And those people who got onto it in the very beginning took the lead, and everybody else began to jump on the bandwagon and start. So it's something that everybody wants to do now. I think the biggest problem that we have is the how do you do it? And that, well, for most businesses, is it.
I mean, again, you know, think about social networking. I mean, you and I have our Twitter accounts and our LinkedIn groups and so forth. But, you know, social networking is like social life. It's really complex. And you mentioned that one-to-one relationship. And that's something that that is actually incredibly difficult. It isn't something that you can lay out a pattern, a Six Sigma, you know, a system for and just replicate it. It's not an assembly line process. Human relationships never have been. And just because, you know, we put machines, we intermediate this communication with a machine, doesn't mean we turned the social component into an issue of mathematics, a question of mathematics. I mean, this is social. This is complicated. This is hard. People are fickle. This will change, and it will change again with the technologies as well.
Well, and no question about it. But I think realistically, what's missing for a lot of people today, you got business, you got marketers, they get so budget crunched. You know, you got to do more and less time with less money because the economy is slumping, and so on and so forth. They don't have to belabor it. You get it. And the big question I think comes into any meeting: what's missing? What's going to bring you back to profitability? And it's something, you know, it's not something external, it is something internal. And what they're missing is something called, and you're talking about it, I'm going to use a different word for it, something called community. What you're missing is a synergy. You know, you've been missing that to optimize businesses. And you
but
mentioned.
Here's the thing about community, it has to be based upon a shared, genuine interest.
No question.
Again, when you're looking at organizations trying to mass replicate these social media success stories that we hear, you simply can't do it within your organization or with your constituents outside your organization. There has to be genuine, honest communication to build real relationships, and that's the basis of community.
Oh, and no question about it. And I think one of the things that happened with community, things all of a sudden, results became intentional as opposed to accidental. Things happen faster. They happen better. And there's that old adage about the power of the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. But to work in concert and to produce, you know, that's really where it's at. You mentioned crowdsourcing. You know, Jeff Howe, Wired Magazine, that's what he and Mark Robinson called it. It was the phenomenon, if I can say the word, was crowdsourcing. And it became a term of choice for so many businesses. And the key is, and you're right, you've got to be going in the same direction.
But when you think about digital natives, you know, here's the difference. You know, I've had some, you know, baby boomer bosses. And, you know, when I say to them, we should take our intellectual property and share it with the world because we're going to make better products, I mean, you can see veins pulsing in their foreheads. The difference is we're talking about a generation, the digital native generation, that has grown up immersed in social networking. I mentioned this before, they actually value things more that they help create. They are more likely to buy them if they help create them. They actually trust content more, information more, if it was crowdsourced. And this runs counter to what those in previous generations are comfortable with. But it is a huge opportunity. And I don't just mean for marketing. you know, for innovation, for product creation. You know, there's been this goal in large organizations for decades, this knowledge management idea where we capture tacit knowledge and we share it throughout our organization. But I'll tell you straight up, I've worked with people in the next cubicle who wouldn't tell me the name of a source. They wouldn't recommend a writer to me because they hold those things to be their differentiators. This is what makes me valuable, my secrets. This generation, the generation of digital natives, that's just not how they think. And that is an exciting opportunity as managers to get in there, tap into that, and leverage it to make better products, to do better business. There is an opportunity here, and it's an exciting one.
Well, the opportunity is like people like yourself, Michelle. What you do is you point out what other people don't see. And I think that's really where the problem in a lot of businesses and social networking is. It's there's things in front of them that they're not used to, they don't see, and they miss it. You shift your focus. You clearly identify the sources that's going to define the decision-making process. And part of that is being able to, quote-unquote, to crowdsource, to understand it, and that community thing I was talking about before, it is that niche that you want to look into where there's that shared collaborative movement forward and everybody's on the same page. It's not like, gee, if I tell you what I've got, you're going to take it away from me and now I'm next.
Let me give you a couple of cool examples, just in case they're ones you haven't heard of. There's an automotive, a new American car company called Local Motors. And what Local Motors does, they don't have a single car designer on their staff. They crowdsource the design of every major component of their automobiles. And then the crowd also votes on the cars, and the most popular ones actually get manufactured. And they get manufactured right here in America in regional micro-facilities. And they go so far as when you buy a car from Local Motors, you actually are expected to go and help build the vehicle. You go and help work with the design, the build team on those vehicles. And that is the kind of idea that is going to resonate with this generation. The idea that it's built locally, that they participate in every stage of the design. There's a t-shirt company called Threadless. They were definitely the early leader in this. You know, every T-shirt design at Threadless is vetted by the crowd. The crowd votes on them, and those votes are factored into what gets produced. I mean, I could give you, you know, another 10, 15 examples, but this is the way the native wants to do business. And for organizations that fail to recognize it and build these communities of ideas and shared interests and shared beliefs with them, I sincerely think they're going to be left behind.
Well, by the way, let me say it. We're starting to run out of time, but let me say it in a different way. What you're talking about also is a focus group. You know, you get enough people that want something in a certain way, then you move.
You don't make things nobody wants to buy.
Yes.
You make things people actually want.
Yes. That's exactly what it is. Don't buy what I think you should have. Let me sell you, quote unquote, what you want. And then
let me work with you to create what you want, and you're already interested and you're already likely to buy.
I can't say anything more than absolutely. You got spot on.
So if you want to learn more about the book, our website is dancingwithdigitalnatives.com. I'm Michelle Manafi. You can find me on Twitter at Michelle Manafi, and LinkedIn, just about anywhere. I'm incredibly easy to find. I actually believe all the stuff I'm saying.
Oh, wait, somebody had fallen down off my chair. I love every second of it. Okay, we're going to chase you down on Twitter.
All right, you do that. I'll look forward to it. Susie's already following me, so, you know.
Thank you. Take care. Good night.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye, Michael.
Follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Said don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Mayor Eisenstein with it. We're going to have some fun again. Mayor, how are you?
Oh, good evening, Michael. That was very interesting, except I was listening to your last guest. The only problem is I don't think you want a car that was built by Mayor Eisenstein. That would be very dangerous, yeah, but I like the idea.
But let me tell you what would happen. I know exactly what would happen by a car that you participated in to get built. On the rear end, it would say, don't vaccinate.
Oh, my God, you've seen my car, you know. Actually, more. I have a skull and crossbones on the back of my car, an emblem, and it says, vaccines cause death. you know. But yeah, I can tell you, it's interesting you bring that up because I'm just looking at the webpage here of Fox News.
Yeah.
And let me just pull it up here. And one of the questions in there on their health page is, let me see if I can find it over here. Do you need a repeat flu shot this fall? Now, let me tell you, what an arrogant title, because no one took it last year. And, you know, that's kind of like the question that the classical example, how often do you beat your wife?
Sure. You're done. There's no way to get out of that.
Pardon?
There's no way to get out of that.
There's no way to get. That's exactly right. You can't answer. That's, you know, and the drug manufacturers are ordering 173 million doses for the upcoming season. That's 6 million more than the maximum ever produced. You know, I mean, they're incredible. I mean, it doesn't make a difference that it didn't work for the swine flu vaccine, that their talk was over-exaggerated, that we had less death this year from flu pneumonia than the last 10 years. And again, one of the reasons in my mind is because people are avoiding the flu vaccine. I mean, there's enough evidence that as the number of people get flu vaccines, more people die from flu and pneumonia. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, Mayor, it goes back to follow the money. You know, who's making money by creating the shots and on and on and on? Because if you're dealing with it, you've got a multi-billion dollar industry in flu shots.
Yeah, let me tell you something. And then they perpetuate their own statistics and lies. Demand for vaccine has been growing in the United States. More than 40% of the population was vaccinated against the flu in the last 10 months. The second year in a row, vaccinations were at so high a level. Previously, only about a third of Americans were getting vaccines, according to government figures. Well, you know, who gives the government figures? The pharmaceutical industry gives them the figures, you know. And so it's kind of like they're trying to convince the population to take something. Oh, my God, it's just unbelievable. But, you know, let's go to a positive note. I want to give thanks to all our incredible men and women who serve in the military, who've given their lives to the military. We kind of think of Memorial Day weekend as barbecues and parties. And let's spend a second thanking everyone, you know, who served our country. And the reason why, we can even have an administration that's as silly as this one, and still we're the greatest country in the world.
Oh, absolutely. No question. I want to go back to what you were talking about with the pharmaceutical industries. We have the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. So when something comes through, it obviously has to be passed by the Food and Drug Administration. What we don't hear is the basic population, and you said it. It's the pharmaceutical industry that does the testing, then goes to the Food and Drug Administration, and the pharmaceutical industry says, it's fine, it's good, it's
right.
Great. Well, if they said it, it must be so, and then somebody puts more money in the bank.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and you know, I believe in capitalism. I'm a very big believer in it.
Yes.
You know, but I think that we need certain guidelines and protections, And one of the protections that's exceptionally needed is if someone works for a regulatory agency, be it the Food and Drug Administration, being the Center for Disease Control, the National Institute of Health, as we're talking about in healthcare, they cannot take a job in the private sector after they leave that has a competing interest. You know, it makes no sense, because otherwise you're best off considering the pharmaceutical industry and the food industry. No, they're exactly the same in that sense. We'll pay you 5 or 6 times as much as you're making in the regulatory agency, and they don't have to bribe you or anything. All they look at the people who favorably voted in your dangerous foods or your dangerous chemicals or your dangerous drugs, and you can be reassured that you will be rewarded down the line.
No question about it. I can't. That's interesting. I can't talk to you if I got my microphone turned off. But anyways, yeah. when you take a look at it, and you look at the industry in the way it is, those natural things that can help. You know, if we go all the way back and we look at what the medicines were, they were plants. They were things that came out of the earth. As we grew, we created the chemical. The chemical, the pharmaceuticals to help people do this and that and whatever. And we've gotten so far away from the natural way to heal. And by the way, allopathic medicine, don't hear me say that there's no place for it. There is. There absolutely is. But there's a lot of money to be made on it. And the average person does not know where to draw that line in the sand to say, okay, I'm taking XYZ medicine that the doctor prescribed. But if I can find a supplement that's natural, that I'm not going to have any kind of side effects from, it's scary, because the minute you find one, somebody's saying that it's not any good, and I think we're controlled by fear.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think there's a tremendous place for allopathic medicine, you know.
Sure.
And I can tell you where they shine the best. They shine absolutely the best in life-threatening emergency type of situations, in trauma. Nothing beats this country for trauma. You know, I mean, it's the greatest country in the world when it comes to that. Our trauma centers around the country, you know, but what they fall down on is in chronic illnesses and chronic problems, where sometimes the treatment is worse than the disease.
Yeah. By the way, absolutely no question about it. I think more and more doctors today, from the interviews that I've been in, people I've talked to, and feedback that I have, more and more doctors today are getting away from that standardized medicine that they've been taught, and they're opening it up to say, well, there are alternatives. That doesn't mean that they completely become a naturopath, but there are alternatives that can work in conjunction with what I've been taught. That's the man or woman that you want to go to, because they're looking at it from a set of eyes that look at it multidimensionally.
You know, and I can tell you what an embarrassment. The Center for Disease Control, which is supposed to be our top regulating agency as far as protecting our public, you know what the silliness of last week warns public to prepare for zombie apocalypse.
You know,
we're spending money in order for them to be silly like this. You know, I tell you, when we have such, the Surgeon General, the Assistant Surgeon General, Ali Khan, instructs readers how to prepare for flesh-eating zombies. Now, it's supposed to be a joke and all that, but you know something, there are serious issues. We've got serious vitamin D deficiencies in this country. We've got chronic illness out of control. You know, and this weekend in Chicago, there's going to be the Autism One conference for parents and professionals to help learn all type of treatments, including alternative treatments, to help their children who've been damaged by vaccines. End of story. That's the bottom line. And there's over 1 million children who all of a sudden, the last few years, have developed these severe neurological illnesses. You mean to tell me that all of a sudden we had some genetic modification in our DNA pool within the last 12 years? And you can date it almost to the date, because you don't see any children or adults in their 30s with autism, 40s, 50s, or 60s. You don't see in their late 20s. You see it only started about 15 years ago. And incidentally, 15 years ago, the Center for Disease Control changed their recommendation from 6 or 7 vaccines to 35 or 40 vaccines. You know, sometimes if it looks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, if it talks like a duck, it ain't going to be anything but a duck.
Or it'll be something else disguised as a duck.
Or something disguised as a duck, yeah. That's right. That's exactly right. You know, we
Go ahead, please. Okay, I think where we're going here, and not you and I, but the country in general, the nation in general, where we're moving with the healthcare programs that we've been, basically they've been shoved down our throat. But the healthcare programs in and of themselves, there are going to be a lot of things eliminated. There's a lot of doctors that can't stay in business anymore because they can't afford the ongoing and continuous expenses, you know, staff and so on and so forth. And they have got to raise their prices and the malpractice goes up and so on and so forth. And, you know, attacking Medicare and all the things that they're talking about doing, while there's billions with a B, billions of dollars going to other countries to help them do this, billions of dollars going on research projects that a lot of them are absolutely ridiculous. The government is spending billions and billions of dollars on everything but taking care of their own.
Oh, my God. You're absolutely so right. You know what I mean? I got a really kind of interesting email this week. You know, the president advised the prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to maybe he should move back to the 1967 borders.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Someone sent me an email saying maybe the United States should move back to the 1959 border so Hawaii is no longer a state.
Oh, I think we should. Wait, no, Arizona and Texas has to go back to Mexico.
Right, exactly.
Let me tell you what the problem with that is, and it's one problem only, where the president didn't have the foresight with this, is that those borders are negotiating points. And if you give them up, you have nothing to negotiate with. And the real issue is not Israel and Palestine. The real issue is Israel and Hamas. Every time Palestine and the Palestinians and the Israeli come to the bargaining tables, they are so close, Hamas drops a bomb. Hamas does this. So the problem is we're working on a problem that we don't have as opposed to the one we do have and is looking bad all the time. Right now what we're doing is we're alienating Israel. We're alienating England. We've alienated France. I don't know who else that we have that's that close to us that we're going to put a wall between.
Yeah, no, I tell you, I mean, it's I just truly hope we get some candidates for 2012 who will kind of see this country the way it is, the greatest country in the world, the greatest country that ever existed. You know, and I'm just, you know, it has nothing to do with Republican, Democrat, Independent. I just don't understand the mentality of what's going on. I mean, it's just like it's exactly what you said. You know, we should be spending our money to take care of our own first. I mean, it's like it makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense.
I know what's going on. A shift in the ideology, a shift in the ideology and the culture of the country. 2 weeks before Barack Obama was, or a week before he was voted into office, he stood there in front of the Union in Acorn and he said, they talked about the fundamental change that's going to go on in America, and that he was going to make sure that the Union and Acorn and those people would have a say in government. Right now, what's going on is we're shifting away from who we have known us to be, and it's more socialistic. It's more communistic in its viewpoint. And this is what's happening.
You know, I could tell you that what really bothered me, and we talked about this before, is what's happening and what happened in Wisconsin, you know, where the teachers went on strike. And I somehow can't fathom the thought of someone who's truly a dedicated teacher not teaching their students. You know, I mean, isn't that what a teacher's all about? I mean, to teach, you know, and what lesson are they telling them that if we don't get enough money, we're not going to teach you anymore? I mean, there's ways of doing it differently, and I'm not arguing if their position was right or wrong, but the idea, and then to top it off, in Wisconsin, they went to doctors who were sympathetic to their cause, who wrote notes and letters giving them permission to leave because they pretended to be sick. Now, that's really, can you imagine if you were, your parent would write you a note so that you're sick when you felt perfectly fine. You know, my grandmother said, you get up and you go to school, and that's it. End the story, you know. Shameful.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. And I think we've gotten off course with education. And I don't mean the higher education, but go to the high schools, the junior high schools, or the middle schools now. That's what it's called. Where is the wood shop? Where's the auto shop? Where's the metal shop?
Right.
Where are those places that teach fundamental skills to go out into the trades? If you don't have these and you're not prepared for it, and especially the way the job market is today, you're going to fall down. And where do you fall down? You break the law, you go to jail, you join a gang, you do something.
Yeah.
So fundamentally,
it makes sense to join a gang if you have no skills. You're better off. That's the most skilled job you can get. It sounds crazy.
Well, there's something. Let's take it a step farther with that. We're starting to run out of time, but let me take that a step farther. If you have a solid foundation, a grounding with your parents, then you have an identity with those parents. If you don't have that foundation and that acceptance at home, you're going to go out and find it somewhere else. The
right.
One thing that we do that's innate within all of us, we need to be acknowledged, we need to be accepted, and we need to have an identity. And if you can't find it in school, if you can't find it within your own religion, if you can't, you're going to go out and find it somewhere. And somewhere, the mayor, that's where the scary part is.
Oh, my God. You're absolutely not kidding, you know. Well, you know, what can we do? Every one of us can do our part, you know, in a sense. And I start by something very simple. You know, if you haven't looked into it, because Michael's talked about this endlessly, look at taking vitamin D. We want to finish on a positive note, because I'm not going to get very much vitamin D this weekend here in the Midwest. I mean, but look into vitamin D. And, Michael, you could tell your listeners what vitamin D they should take.
Oh, it's vitamin D3.
Ah, that's the
yes.
Best.
That's the one.
You know,
let me get we're over time. Let me ask you this website we can find you at and find the vitamin D3.
Homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. That's homefirst.com. And we have a great sale running this weekend on vitamin D. So if anyone just goes to the website, you'll see all the information on it.
Hey, by the way, have a wonderful 3 days off. I know you're not going
to
get it off.
Happy holidays to you and Susie.
You too. Take care.
Be well. Be well. Thank you. Bye.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. Incredible places to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day.
Ben Noman is with us. He's the co-author of Pocket Truths for Success, 365 Daily Principles to Become the Most Successful Person That You Know. He's got a very unique story of adversity and triumph. It's enabled him to choose a clear path of success rather than follow a destructive path of hardship. And as a financial professional, he qualifies for the $1 million roundtable each year, has been recognized twice as Wealth Manager of the Year in the St. Louis Magazine. He's also a professional speaker whose goal is to help individuals uncover their true potential and natural talents. Let me say the word again, natural talents. And in his capacity, he's impacted organizations including the Minnesota Vikings, Mars Snack Foods, and he's also, again, the author of Pocket Principles for the Insurance Business and Fight the Good Fight, A Mother's Legacy Lives On. And thank you so much for being here. Ben, when we talk about people in general today, we all need that certain something that will keep us moving, keep us motivated. And if we don't have it, sometimes we go down the wrong path. And it could be just as simple as getting up in the morning and reading a quote of the day to motivate you, inspire you, and get you to move forward. So let me take you all the way back to the beginning, the Pocket Truths for Success, the 365 daily principles to become the most successful person you know. Where did it come from? When I say where did it come from, where was that light bulb that went on for you to say, this is it, this is something that everybody can follow?
Well, Michael Ray, it's such a fabulous question, and I can tell you that, you know, my daily inspiration when I ask myself the question, what am I fighting for a single day, it's the family that I have been blessed with. It's those gifts that are in my life, and my inspiration for writing my Pocket Principles book, and this book in particular, Pocket Truths for Success, comes from a nap that my son, when he was 6 months old, his name is Isaac, he was napping on me, and I was reading him before he took his nap, Life's Little Instruction Book. And I said, you know, I said, we need Life's Little Instruction Book for motivation, for inspiration, because when we can be motivated at the beginning of each and every single day, we know that we're capable of achieving greatness. And that was the Pocket Truth concept.
Wouldn't it be interesting if you could pick up the Pocket Truth and every day in the morning you picked it up and you looked at it and you saw yourself within the framework of each one of the days? And I would venture to guess that if there's commonality inside those truths for everybody to capture, one way or the other, there's going to be a familiar scenario that they'll identify with. And most of us get in trouble is because we don't see what's in front of us. And sometimes the smallest indicator can open up the world for you.
Such an incredible point that you make. And I'd love to take it back to something you just mentioned with Dr. Eisenstein in your last interview is, you know, the fact that it starts with, you know, especially with children, you know, the future of this great country, regardless of Republican or Democrat, as you guys mentioned. You know, it's that belief that you instill in yourself from your upbringing and your family, the people that you're surrounded with, that really give you the ability to feed your mind with pearls of wisdom and strength to take on each day. And that's what the book's about. It's about opening it up. You don't have to read day one, day two, day three. Open it up. Pick, you know, 252 and read it and find that inspiration to help you see that potentially there are challenges that you're facing that you can absolutely overcome with a little more belief in yourself.
Now, by the way, when let's take you all the way back to when you were a kid. We talk about adversity to triumph. Where was it that you got knocked down? Where was it that what were the challenges that you faced that you eventually had to move through?
Yeah, the most significant challenge that I faced in my life is my mother was diagnosed in 1983 with a rare muscle disease called amyloidosis. And my mother was given 2 to 4 years to live. Her doctor at the Boston Medical Center in Boston mentioned to her that she was only the second woman under 40 years old that she had ever seen or heard of being diagnosed with the disease. So, Michael Ray, we are talking about the rarest of the rare. And my mother fought every single day to be a champion of life. She was a divorced mother of 2 young children, and she left behind a journal with her own pearls of wisdom that I write about in my other book, Fight the Good Fight, A Mother's Legacy Lives On. And by far and away, she's the greatest champion of life I've ever known. And even though amyloidosis took her life on November 2nd, 1986, all she did was take the pen that she was writing with in her journal, and she passed it on to me. And every single day, I feel a responsibility to my wife, Amy, and my son, Isaac, and my daughter, Kennedy Rose, to take that pen and now instill pearls of wisdom for them to live a very strong and purposeful life when my day comes.
So in essence, what we're really dealing with is the Pocket Truths for Success is a legacy.
It's all about legacy. And, yeah. You know, I think what's interesting is when you have a mission and you have a purpose and you can surrender to a big legacy, something bigger than you. You know, it's interesting. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, and yesterday I was with a wonderful Fortune 500 company in Portland, Oregon. And the leader of this company had a mission statement for that organization that I think just spoke to legacy and to life. And when you hear this, it makes you, if you read this every morning, you could live every day to the fullest. And it said to inspire people to live and to dream courageously and with purpose. And I think it speaks to legacy. And if you can inspire yourself every day, you can maximize the gift that every day has in store for you.
Yeah, but the inspiration in and of itself, and it's too bad we have to say it this way, Ben, and the inspiration in and of itself has got to come from a challenge that you faced, and now you see the inspiration, and you recognize the inspiration, and for that moment, you begin to realize here is a fix to the problem. And I think that in and of itself has got to be the magic of it, when you recognize that the book is not a book. The book is something alive, and it's talking about me. And that's where I think the most important thing that we can say is.
That's so much truth in exactly what you're saying, Michael Ray, because it's really when you're knocked down, you have a choice. You know, your choice is I will either stay knocked down or I can focus on the solution. I can focus on a way to get myself up off that mat of life, and I can focus on doing the best I can to stay positive, to stay motivated, to be inspired, and to focus on making a difference.
And by the way, that being inspired, being motivated, it's something that can come very natural. You don't have to be shouting from the rooftops every day. It can be a very, very quiet inner strength that shows up in everything that you do, and it doesn't have to be loud. It doesn't have to be overpowering, but it can be that strength within you that leads you to where you need to be.
There's no doubt about it. You know, it goes back once again, Michael Ray, to what you had mentioned in the previous interview, which is, you know, it starts at home. It's the internal belief you have in yourself, but it's also those people that you surround yourself with. It's your family. It's the loved ones. It's the people who nurture you. They support you. They're there to help you grow. And that support over time helps you later on in life to realize that through any obstacle, through great mentors and advocates, and by committing to being a lifelong learner, you can accomplish anything.
By the way, there was something that I've used on the air a few times, and when I got divorced in 2002. It's just a couple of years off. When I got divorced in 2002, and we're still good friends. We talk. She's remarried. She's a wonderful woman. But it was very interesting because I got left in the house, and there were ghosts in there. And when I say ghosts, I don't mean goblins, but I could still hear her coming up the stairs and so on and so forth. And the hardest thing I had to do was to live alone. So I'm standing by, I'm in the bedroom one day, and this is a true story. I'm standing by the bookcase, and this reddish pink piece of paper falls out of the bookcase. Now, it doesn't belong to any book that I own. I have no idea where this thing came from, and all of a sudden, it was there. And this is what it said, and I still have it today. May you have enough happiness to make you sweet, enough trials to make you strong, enough sorrow to keep you human, and enough hope to make you happy. The happiest people don't necessarily have the best of everything. They just make the most of everything that comes their way. Giving someone all of your love is never an assurance that they will love you back. Don't expect love in return just for it to grow in their hearts. But if it doesn't, be content it grew in yours. And if you take that and you apply that to life, what you do, make sure that you're content that whatever gratification came from it, that you got it. And whatever somebody's going to do with it is going to be up to them.
That's right. That is so beautiful. And, you know, do you ever wonder where that came from, Michael Ray?
Oh, I'm sure I know, but who knows? Yeah. Yeah. but it showed up out of nowhere, and it's one of those things that I would call a miracle.
How often do you read that miracle?
Probably when I come across it, probably every 6 months or so I'll see it.
Yeah, because I think that's one of the things when you think about legacy, it's, you know, individuals will be touched by notes of that nature, by things that people said. And oftentimes when you have the courage to go back and reflect on those incidents, those letters, those things that the people have said that have touched your life, that's where you can focus on that legacy and that bigger purpose. Because hearing things like that motivates me. It motivates you to live a bigger life, a more fuller focus on the right things. It's about love, it's about purpose, and it's about passion for life.
And also, I believe in miracles. And a miracle isn't that, you know, all of a sudden you're flying through the air and that's a miracle. A miracle is when you're at the supermarket and there's somebody who is older that can't reach up on top to get what they want. And you reach up and you get it for them. And when you see the appreciation in their face, when they realize that the world is not shoving them into the closet or in a corner, that people actually do care, that is a miracle. And if everybody could create those miracles every day, what a world we live in.
Yeah, I call those the smaller miracles. It's those smaller miracles make such a big difference in people's lives.
Oh, absolutely. No questions at all. Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, I pick it up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What do I, Michael Ray, get? What do I get that I didn't have before?
What you're going to get, Michael Ray, is that daily belly punch of inspiration that we all search for. You know, the world is so complex. There is so much negativity that's out there, and we will all have bad days. But the book was written with the purpose and the objective of helping people on those bad days pick up the book, read it quickly, get that small dose of inspiration, that belly punch of inspiration, to give you the belief in yourself that you can continue to move forward. And Dr. Eisenstein mentioned, the vitamin D and the vitamin D3. I actually call it, and it's actually free because you get it from yourself every day, is take your vitamin B. It's that belief. And that's what the book is really written for, is for you to take that vitamin B, that belief in yourself, every single day so that you can use your natural talents to make a big difference.
Let me tell you, one of the lessons that I've learned in life, and I think this is the most powerful lesson that I've ever learned, if I have a bad day, somewhere in the middle of that bad day, I'm going to say thank you. Because the bad day always turns out, if you'll open your eyes and look, the bad day always turns out to be a lesson that you need to learn.
There's no doubt about it. I always say that the biggest obstacles mask the greatest opportunities. And you know, my mother's story and the way that she decided and she chose to live her life every day really gave my brother and I, you know, a toolbox of wisdom and belief in ourselves that no matter what happens to us in any day, that we can make a difference, we can get ourselves up off that mat of life, and we can go out and fight. And it's a choice. It's a personal choice for all of us every day.
No question. Hey, Ben Newman, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you in the books at.
Absolutely. I'd really encourage everybody. I love connecting with people. You can go to bennewman.net and connect with me on Facebook. Connect with me on Twitter. I love the new friends and the new relationships. And the book, Pocket Truths for Success, you can learn more about at Amazon.com. You can pick it up at BarnesandNoble.com or Pocket-Truths.com.
Wonderful. Love every second of it. And hey, Ben Newman, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael Ray, thank you so much for having me, and I just wanted to say a special thank you to all of the troops that are fighting to give us the freedom that we have, and may we keep the memories of those that have made the greatest sacrifice for us in our minds and our thoughts when we're with our families on this wonderful Memorial Day weekend.
Absolutely. Double ditto on that. Hey, thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Michael Ray. Take care. Have a great night.
Good night.
And a love who's burning light will warm them with a knife. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. I am sure who have told you
of time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Peter Voltaggio with us. He is the author of Business Lessons from an Alien. He's an award-winning Fortune 100 business consultant, transformational leader, co-creator of the Business Vitalizer, CEO and co-founder of the Lumi Company, author, speaker, successful international management and workforce developer, and he holds a bachelor's degree of science from USCD in bioengineering and is a master's degree in human resources and organizational development. Peter, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Way. Great to be here.
Hey, Bob, did I pronounce your name right?
You did. If you want to say it a la Italian, it would be Voltaggio.
Voltaggio, I got it. Okay, I just want to make
but
sure.
But you did very well.
Thank you, we got it. Now, by the way, business lessons from an alien. That, you know, let me tell you what I hear in that. It's called Business Lessons from Somebody Who Knows How to Do Business and Does It Different Than Everybody Else Does to Be Successful. Am I close here?
Absolutely. And it's placed in an entirely different universe. So that's how different the business is run.
Now, when we talk about business, you know, business, obviously, Peter, business today and business 10, 15, 20 years ago, it's different. Is there anything that within a company itself, anybody doing business, whether you're an entrepreneur sitting at home with your computer or you've got a brick and mortar store, you've got 1,000 people out there, is there anything that's constant that everybody should take advantage of to be able to be successful in this very unsure marketplace today?
Oh, absolutely. There's a myriad of things. In fact, most organizations, and this includes the majority of my clients that are Fortune 500 organizations, still operate for the most part off of a 100-year-old model of what business is. But if you look at, just as you said, even the past couple of decades, most of the rules to be, for example, have been broken. They don't apply anymore. Even our organizational structures don't apply anymore. So this is for anybody. You mentioned entrepreneurs and small businesses as well. This applies to all of them. You can't run business the way you did 10, 20 years ago. In fact, we've got folks coming into the workplace now that say, listen, if you try to manage me the way you did my parents, it's not going to happen. I'm out of here. And those that are staying put are doing so because of just the economy right now. But I've seen it before. Once times get better, all of a sudden the walls become transparent and they leave because their mind is wired differently than the way we're used to it. We're brought up in the old style of how we ran businesses, from our org structures to our management styles. I'll tell you one more thing, Michael. We've got, for the first time, we've got 5 different generations in the workplace today. We've never had that before in the history of business. And each of these generations has their own needs, their own values, their own aspirations of what they want to do with their work-life balance.
Now, by the way, being a bioengineer, that in and of itself says something to me. If you're an architect, if you're an engineer, you create a process to do something. You just don't accidentally jump into something and hope it's going to work out at the end. You plot, you plan, you structure it. You make sure that you check it at certain times along the way to make sure that you're hitting the mark. Isn't that what's missing in most businesses?
It is missing, and when they do it, for example, a la Six Sigma or some of the process improvement or reengineering work, the element that they most forget or that usually is last in line is the people. That is where the change actually happens. And you mentioned my bioengineering background. I actually learned about this from the inside out, literally from studying the insides of people. And once I got out into the workforce and got into management very early in my career, I realized a lot of that logical, analytical thinking didn't help in terms of managing groups of people. They didn't go according to the textbook that I was used to. When you have somebody on a table and you open them up, if something's not working to textbook, you know what to repair or reroute or replace. But when you sew them up and they start walking around, they don't necessarily go by logic. So there have to be other principles that you need to apply in order to be able to work with them.
Now, by the way, Peter, in today's world, if it doesn't work, you go to your counselor and you get psychological help. But that doesn't quite work either. I think what we're really dealing with here, when we're dealing with businesses today, the most important thing that we can have is a connection, a community, basically, a community-sourced business, because it's the people within the business that's either going to make it or break it and hit that bottom line. Years ago, we had the mom-and-pop organizations. We had camaraderie. We had people working together. You walked in a brick-and-mortar store, and they knew your name. They knew your family. They knew your dog's name, and everything was good. You had that connection. Mom-and-pops got overran by the major corporations that couldn't compete. Major corporations got in business, and then down the road, the same thing with the mom-and-pops happened to them. They got on a multinational level, and they started losing business. They couldn't compete, so they outsourced. And the people, when the jobs started to go, these people their jobs were replaced by outsourcing, they went home, and they became entrepreneurs, and they became the mom-and-pops. And I think what we're seeing is a full circle. And one of the most important things that I've heard, and you've said it, there's got to be that degree of humanness, that human contact, that collaboration within a business to be successful today.
And it's tricky because we are stuck in a model of what a business is supposed to be like, and the language of that business has been accounting. And we have made the purpose of the business the profit. And what comes out in the book and the story format that it's in, one of the activation codes is that we have to break that connection between our purpose and profit. Profit is no more a purpose for a business as oxygen is for me. All of us are within 2 minutes of death if we don't have oxygen. The brain in a couple of minutes will be done. And it doesn't store oxygen. So if it doesn't have it, it's not going to make it. Well, businesses say the same thing. If I don't have cash flow, we're done. Correct. But that isn't the purpose that invigorates and that gives you that collaboration, that creativity that we're needing in organizations today. So we're needing to find something more powerful to rally around. And, of course, profit needs to be part of our oxygen, how we survive, but it's not the only reason. I'll give you a quick example. One of my favorites that's doing this quite well is Volvo. Volvo, and this is just for one of the departments of Volvo, their purpose, why they come to work, is because they want to achieve nobody ever dying in a Volvo. And they're actually pushing themselves to go even further and say, by such and such a date, such and such a year, we want to get to the point where nobody will die by a Volvo. Now, that's a strong purpose. These folks would come in and say, I'm doing something that's important. Yes, we have to make money, but now I'm willing to give you that discretionary effort. Now I'm you have my head, you have my hands, you have my heart.
Okay, now, by the way, and there's got to be that combination of the bottom line and the cash flow, because if there isn't, then those people don't have a job and there's no place to get up and go to work in the morning. So purpose can have a twofold end result. That purpose of that move together to get an end result, but that end result in business especially has got to produce an income, a cash flow, so they can stay in business and keep that purpose going. So I think there's a kind of an interesting razor's edge that you have to walk with that and stay focused and not fall either one way or the other.
Absolutely. And it's the same thing when I get up in the morning. I know that I have air and I need oxygen, but I don't make that the reason I get up in the morning. So I'm pursuing, what turns me on, what enlightens me, what makes me powerful, what makes me feel like I'm contributing to society is not my search of getting more and more air. I need that to survive, and the business needs the cash flow to keep itself going. But in order to tap into, and this is one of the differences also that you had asked about, Mike Ray, about what's different now than it used to be before, with change being so fast and globalization happening every minute that businesses are running and they're competing on a global level now, I'm needing literally to turn on and to tune in and to connect all the minds that are available within my organization, because as problems come up, nobody may have experienced them before. I can't call the old salt, you know, the master, the one who's been around for 20 years, because they'll say, never seen that before. So now I need to have, on a quick basis, the means of being able to come up with creative, innovative solutions, and even better, to beat the market at some new idea. But I can't do that unless I've got people that are heart and soul in the organization versus just working for money.
Oh, no, by the way, one of the things that I think the businesses that are successful today, because of that over-competitive marketplace out there, they're keeping the customers that they have now, and it's starting from within. And everything you're talking about is starting to glow within these businesses, and they're making the customers that they have happy, and they're not losing them, and they're sustaining their ability to be alive and move in this world. And as they grow, they'll grow, but they're going to grow from in. It used to be you grew externally. That doesn't work anymore. And you've got to do everything that you're talking about right now and grow internally. And that's where that's sustainability that will cause somebody to survive the financial crisis we're in.
And that applies to all aspects of the business. One of the work that type of work that I do for organizations is in bringing in the right talent. And typically what they look for is, where's the star? Where's the superstar? And they're willing to give bonuses and go above and beyond to pull in the superstar. My work has been, why don't you work with the intellectual capital that already you have? Why don't you develop the talent that already is here? And it will, I guarantee you, it will beat any single superstar that you can bring in.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, I wouldn't argue that fact no matter what. But the one thing that I have seen, Peter, that has destroyed businesses, not necessarily put them out of business, but slowed down the growth of the business. You go to the CEO, CFO, COO, who's ever in charge, and you get them to sit down and write down what they think that their subordinate, the one right below them, what their job is supposed to be. And then you get that subordinate to write down what that person below them, his job is supposed to be. And then you let it trickle back up, and they're writing down what they think their job is supposed to be. 9 out of 10 times when you match it all up, it's never the same. So it's staying on the same page, moving in the same direction with the same focus. And communication has a lot to do with the success or non-success of a business, and it's in that internal communication. Because you say it doesn't necessarily mean they understand it in the way that they heard it.
In fact, that's step one. And you said it beautifully in the book that comes out through this story, is this alien then asks, well, wait a minute, you're bringing up all these issues about your company, about your organizations, and about how you manage them. Let me ask you a question. Do you have a blueprint? I'm like, what do you mean blueprint? Oh, you mean like a business plan? So, no, I'm not talking about business plan. I'm not talking about your marketing and about your finance. I'm talking about the DNA of your organization. Do you know what that means? And, of course, in business we go, no, I don't know what that means. So the book goes into explaining, here's why you're having issues. If you don't get at the genetic level of your organization and know what it's made from its infrastructure, if you even have an infrastructure, you're not going to be able to solve. You'll be plugging in holes that would keep popping up in your dam for years on end until you get to the bottom of it, and that's where the book starts.
Oh, no question about that. As a matter of fact, is the book or better yet? If I pick the book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover, I set it down. I put into practice what the book has said. And then 2 months from now, I pick the book up and I start to read it all over again. Am I going to see it each time that I read it in more depth? Is the book alive, really? That's what I'm asking you.
Yeah, and that's quite intuitive of you to pick that up, Michael Ray, because that's what it's designed to do. And that's exactly why it was put in a story format, because it is so different from what we're used to that we're needing all of the voices that are represented in the book. There are six characters in the book. It's written quasi-screenplay so that you are watching the movie while being in it. And so it's not somebody teaching you what you should do. It is a mind-expanding experience. It literally is a journey. You crash land in this other place with these people, and each voice is represented in your head. There's the naysayer, the one that says, this is a bunch of bunk, it'll never work, I've made a lot of money without any of this. There's the astrophysicist, this is somebody who is also in this a crew member, who says, now wait a minute, what this alien's explaining to us right now actually does have some science background, so it's supporting some of these laws that should apply in businesses today, and so on. So in your head, you are hearing these different voices represented, so everybody will be in a different place with it. Come back 2 months later, you might identify more with another voice, another character, and you'll pick up a whole new set of learnings just from rereading it.
You know what I think would have been a great way to finish the book, and I'm listening very closely to you. At the very end of it, when you the business owner, the person that needs that help, are addressing the alien, and the alien looks at you and say, I have one more thing to say to you, and they would say what? And say, well, actually, you're the alien, I'm not.
Isn't that true? I have to tell you a funny story. When we were doing the one of the revisions, we needed to have it in hard copy. So where I do my business is a large office retailer, and they also print some of the workbooks that we produce here. And my wife actually went to pick up the copy. We send the file over. She then goes a couple hours later to go pick it up. And the man behind the counter says, you know, I'm sorry. He says, I don't have it ready. And my wife says, but I see it. It's on your screen. He says, I could get fired for this. He said, I opened it up so that to print it, but I got sucked into the story. I'm into page 24. We're not supposed to read our client files. He says, I got pulled into the story. So that's the power of story, is being able to get you in. Of course, we said, but by all means, you could enjoy reading it, but please give me a copy so we can continue with the book.
You know, there's a little more to the power of story than the power of story than truly meets the eye. And in the power of the story, when somebody actually sees themselves within the story, there's a neurological component that most people have no idea that it even exists that takes place. And within the story, when somebody recognizes themselves within the story, you can actually change brain chemistry of an audience out there. Because if they see something that makes them feel good about what they're seeing, because it could be a fix to a problem, they'll actually get a flood of dopamine and they'll feel good about it, which calls themselves to action to do whatever it is. So when you do something in story form and it's recognizable to the person that's reading it, seeing it, experiencing it, the story becomes them.
Now you're talking about something that's near and dear to my heart. Neuroscience was one of the disciplines that I emphasized in my biomedical engineering training. And you are absolutely right on with that. And story is really forced listening, because your mind is giving voice to these characters. And every time your brain identifies with a learning or gets a aha moment, which is an electrical storm when you look at it through a functional MRI, it's literally what happens. New associations get made and your brain just lights up. Your neuropharmacology just goes crazy. And if you are able to have enough of those, which is what happens with this book, then your mind can't go back. And my job's been done, which is to push out your paradigms about how you view organizations. Now you've created the space for new learning to come in. In fact, that's one of the activation codes in the book about pertinent information. It's not so much acquiring new information as it is also getting rid of old ones, old beliefs, old assumptions. Otherwise, you're going to force fit whatever that's new that you'll learn into your same old structure.
Are you familiar with the somatic marker?
I am. Wait.
Okay, good. Okay, that was, who was it? It was Damasio, and I think it was like in the early 1990s when he created the hypothesis. And basically what it is, it's an unconscious reconstruction of the past through a memory, because you'll see something very familiar and is tied to a current experience. I think the magic of connecting to any audience, whether it's in a book or live, etc., is intentionally triggering the recognition of what they're looking for and then following it with a solution that you have to offer. And effectively, if you go to major advertisers, that method of recognition strategy has been around for years. They connect with an audience by offering a recognizable emotional appeal. And that's behind all of those ads that drive you to make buying decisions. And those markers are strategically placed to trigger predetermined responses. And I think if you've done that in the book, I think it's brilliant, because now you're talking about neuroimagery. It's all. It's not somebody who's just participating in reading. They become the book, because in that moment, it's not anybody in the book doing anything. It's you.
And to give you an example of that, somebody said, how come we can't connect with Blion, who is the alien that they read about in the book, that actually is the voice of wisdom in the book? And we said, well, who says you can't? And they said, well, the book ended, and I have more questions. I'd love to learn more. Well, Blion has a Facebook, and the first time it went up, it had 60 people, I don't even know how they found out about it, signed up with Blion, who's this alien that comes from a whole other universe. What they're waiting for, what they want to hear, is yet to be determined, because Blion hasn't spoken yet, but it's continuing. And that's the, in fact, somebody who had read the book heard an interview on Coast to Coast and said, this person that's on the program supposedly was transported to some planet, and the planet he described sounded just like the story in your book. Did you channel this? I don't know about that, but this is a place that exists somewhere, and now people are wanting to connect with it, and it's just happening from reading the book. It's quite fascinating.
It's probably existed and happened somewhere in everybody's mind, and it's that connection that we're really dealing with. Because when we deal with a connection with anybody, anything, you've got to recognize it. Understanding it doesn't mean anything. You understand it, goes to the front part of your brain, spins around, and at night it's gone. But recognition goes to the limbic system. It goes to that emotional part of the brain. And that, when the right time comes, causes that call to action. And a decision is made usually in a millisecond when something happens. Anyways, we're running out of time. I could talk to you all night about this, Peter. Website we can find you at.
BusinessLessonsFromAnAlien.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. I've appreciated your time.
My pleasure. Have a great holiday weekend as well.
Take care. You too. Good night.
Good night.
Smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap. Have a wonderful weekend.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.